Welcome to Season 2 of the Cultural Cultivators Podcast, Bubble Eye Creative and Cultivate Labs, where we delve into various aspects of film culture and speak with entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and creators who are shaping and pushing the boundaries of their respective fields. Join us as we cultivate a greater appreciation for the beauty and complexity of the film experience. Follow us on all social media platforms at Bubble Eye Creative, or on Instagram at cultural.cultivators. Cultivators is with a K. Anthem Salgado has a multidisciplinary artist background. He is a formally trained leadership coach, business consultant, trainer, and founder of Art of Hustle Professional Development Program, which has earned over 65-star reviews. Salgado has twice held the role of Director of Communications and has given workshops to reputable institutions such as the Brooklyn Museum and Center for Cultural Power. Anthem also served as our Creative Growth Artist Accountability Coach, a Marketing Masterclass Instructor, and is even currently my own Leadership Coach. In this conversation, Anthem describes a simple twist that can reframe the narrative most artists have been conditioned to accept.
Most artists, irrespective of genre and where they live in the United States, all have the same narrative. Do it by yourself, do hard work, you'll be discovered, don't worry about money, money is evil. So how is it that we've all been acculturated to the same narrative across geographies, across cultural backgrounds, because it's been institutionalized, right? A narrative that works out super well if you're well-resourced, have access to money and opportunities and people. But if you come from a historically marginalized community and you try to do, don't think about money, don't do everything by yourself, just do hard work, that stuff can actually damage you as a person, as a human. Right? It's very isolating to work in that way. At the end of the day, I think it's a career killer.
Also in this conversation, Anthem talks about the origin story of the Art of Hustle, how prioritizing communication can solve a lot of your problems, and how the idea of artistry and entrepreneurship are more connected than one would think. You can find more information on Anthem at artofhustle.com. Thank you for coming into the studio today, Anthem. We are so happy that you're here. I can't believe this is the first time you've been to our studio, even though you've been coaching our artists for more than 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah. Always been virtual in this space. So yeah, it's a beautiful space. Glad to be here. There's something about location and site and placement that helps ground everything. So it's nice to be here.
And speaking of grounding, one of the first questions that we ask all of our guests is, if there was an ancestor or someone that has transitioned on, who would you like to call into the space and dialogue today to help us ground?
Gosh, you know, I thought about that question. I honestly still don't have the best answer for it, but I'm looking at some of the art in the room. And what's coming forward right now is a former instructor I had in college whose name is Carlos Villa. So we'll call Carlos Villa into the space.
Carlos Villa was your instructor?
Yeah.
Dude, that's...
He was very supportive, very chill dude. He was fantastic.
What class was it?
It was a class called Worlds in Collision, which is what he's, you know, for a lot of his students, what he's best known for. So in art school, there's not a lot of like very overt ethnic studies classes. They're not called that, but his class was basically that. It was a way to talk about culture in an art environment that otherwise would not have existed. So yeah, that class was called Worlds in Collision. And so many people participated in it as a student and helped grow it after the fact. And if you look it up, it's just super cool, and I'm very grateful to have been part of it.
Where was that class?
That was at San Francisco Art Institute, which no longer exists. They had survival
issues,
dilemmas.
They should have taken some of your courses. Maybe they take your course. That's so sick, though. Wow, yeah. Rest in peace.
Mm-hmm.
His exhibit was my son's first.
at Asian Art Museum.
Beautiful, beautiful. So what's cool about Carlos is I got introduced to his work from a book called Mixed Blessings. And that was way before I ever met him. So it was cool to kind of like sort of be familiar with his work and then finally be in a class and be like, oh, that's the same dude from the book. So yeah, very cool. Very cool guy. Very cool experience.
What was his teaching style like?
I can't really speak to his style more than just like his vibe as a person. Super approachable, always wanted to help, and just very willing to give advice and make introductions. He was just like super generous in spirit. That's what I remember about him. And I can't speak to his style because I feel like his style showed up in other ways, right? Just like the crafting of a class called Worlds in Collision with the concepts and the content was his style, right? That's really what I feel like showed up and made an impression on me and lots of other people who took that class.
And so I know you, I mean, I've known you for decades, quite frankly, and in this last decade, mostly as a coach.
Yep.
But before that iteration of yourself, you were an artist.
Yes.
Can you talk more about that and what art form and medium you're into?
Yeah. So I graduated with a visual arts degree. I've always been multidisciplinary. So at the start of my career, everything was pointing towards illustration. So lots of drawing and painting. And then when I got to Art Institute, just did way more dabbling. So started revisiting photography, got into conceptual art, installation art, performance art. And then after college, I found myself hanging out with a lot of activists slash poets. And so I too tried my hand at poetry and literature, writing, you know, prose, fiction, just dabbling, really. And then looking at a lot of that writing, I realized most of my stuff was written from the first-person perspective. And it occurred to me that all of that could easily translate to monologue. And then that's what got me into thinking about performance for theater. And so diving all in, I went into solo performance, but I also figured, hey, if I'm going to do this, might as well also try my hand at commercial acting. So got lucky to get representation in the city and score a bunch of industrials and commercial gigs and things like this. Throughout the entire span, I was also supporting myself as an arts administrator. So I got to be a creative, but I also got a chance to see what goes on the back end as far as like producing and making things happen and making a show happen, promoting it, marketing it, et cetera. And so that was pretty much like maybe 20 years compressed into a couple minutes, but that's what it was. Yeah.
And is that the origin story of Art of Hustle?
That was the background. That was like the prequel to Art of Hustle. So in 2008, when the world economy basically collapsed, I was a gigging artist, which is most artists do. You don't have one job. You have like five that you have on rotation. So when the jobs started to dry up, I just didn't lose faith. I thought something will happen. And then nothing happened because the world was falling apart. So I got to a point where I was feeling super strained and sort of like desperate and depressed and frustrated. And I got to the point where I said, you know what? What would I do if I had to offer value? What's the thing that I think would be most important? And it occurred to me, among many ideas that I had, professional development for artists. So that's how Art of Hustle was born. I figured I'll offer it because that's what the world needs. That's what I perceived. And so I went ahead and said, if you can't find a job that offers you the thing, just do the job, make the job. And that's how I started my business in 2010. And so it's been gone through many, many iterations since. But yeah, that was the beginning of it.
20 years. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost 24.
Wow. 14.
14. 14. I'm so bad at math.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not that kind of Asian.
I'm like, don't fast forward too far.
I'm
I got more life to live.
I'm aging us. I love that you wanted to fill a need.
Yes. Yes. And I think most entrepreneurs do. That a lot of people define entrepreneurship as problem solving, right? Because if you're going to sell something that people want, it has to fulfill a need. So even when I teach beginning marketing, beginning promotions for artists, entrepreneurs, that's one of the ways that I communicate it or ask folks to think about it is, well, what is the need you're fulfilling for your specific audience? So there's always got to be a bridging of that gap if you're going to get into artist entrepreneurship.
With artists, we're so focused on the craft and getting good at the craft that we don't think about the business side of it.
Yes, that's hugely problematic. So when I went to school, we had an elective like, oh, how do you build your portfolio? How to get shown in a gallery? These were electives, which meant you did not have to take it, which the institution was communicating to the student population, this is not valuable. But it is valuable, because if you don't know how to create your portfolio, if you don't know how to present yourself, if you don't know how to get shown in a gallery or submit your work to a space to get representation, et cetera, then you don't have a career. So it's actually hugely important. And so I feel like that's the gap I was trying to bridge in the initial formation of Art of Hustle. Until you get institutional support and backup, you have to be your own institution. So I always ask artists when they first start to work with me is I invite them to think about what it might be for them to operate as a micro arts organization, right? Eventually, you know, knock on wood, assuming everything goes well, you will have that institutional backing. But until you do, you have to be your own institutional backing. So think about all the pieces that an institution would offer you. You need to start giving that to yourself, meaning marketing, promotions, business thinking, et cetera.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't think about that.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, but that's how we've been acculturated. It speaks to a bigger problem is most artists, irrespective of genre and where they live in the United States, all have the same narrative. Do it by yourself. Do hard work. You'll be discovered. Don't worry about money. Money's evil. So how is it that we've all been acculturated to the same narrative across geographies, across cultural backgrounds, because it's been institutionalized, right? A narrative that works out super well if you're well-resourced, have access to money and opportunities and people. But if you come from a historically marginalized community and you try to do, don't think about money, don't do everything by yourself, just do hard work, that stuff can actually damage you as a person, as a human, right? It's very isolating to work in that way. At the end of the day, I think it's a career killer.
Yeah, and I think that's why so many artists have this messaging that art is reserved for the wealthy.
Yes, and maybe it is, right? The way it's built right
like
now.
It's a luxury to be an artist.
Yes. I get that. So that's where the twist comes in is BIPOC folks, how do we start to reclaim our sense of community inside the art field, right? So instead of do it by yourself, do it with everybody, right? A lot of us BIPOC folks come from historically disenfranchised communities, right? So it speaks to larger issues outside of just art making for its own sake. Like how do we refocus art and reframe it so that it actually works for us in terms of our values as community members.
Yes. This is what I love about Anthem. We literally allow the conversation to flow and it goes to where it needs to go.
I trust it.
Speaking of, I want to ask, because I'm just being 100% honest right now, Anthem is my leadership coach. We started working together about a couple months ago now, but I just feel like after every session, I get so much out of the 1 hour that I literally fired my therapist. I was like, this is uncovering and just digging deeper than all of my therapy sessions in the past 2 years in one session with you. And it all stems to this idea that you're talking about, the inequality and just how BIPOC folks have been conditioned to think about art and this scarcity mentality. around resources. So I just wanted to ask you, as someone who thinks in a sort of different way, like, how did you get there yourself?
Heartbreak.
Well, let's get into it.
You got to get your heart broken. And so for me, I felt like I followed all the rules, right? As an artist, I did everything. And when I saw opportunities drying up for me as far as gigs and jobs and opportunities to show and present my work, I thought, well, something's wrong because I did all the stuff that they said I was supposed to do, right? Keep your head down, just produce good work, believe in yourself, don't give up, right? It's like those are all very common sayings. So then you just have to go through the heartbreak and say, well, something's missing. So what is that thing? And so I don't think entrepreneurship solves everything, but I do believe it's a gateway to thinking more deeply about what can be included in your master plan.
What's missing?
Yeah, what's missing? I mean, I don't want to do a martial arts metaphor, but I will.
Do now. It.
But it's Come like, on. You know what I mean? It's like, you'll see it a lot in like kung fu movies or whatever. It's like someone thinks they have this art that's fabulous, and then they get their butt kicked by a bully or villain or something. And then they ask themselves the same question. Something's missing. Right. And then there's always the training montage, right? And where they find out all the pieces that have been missing and they strengthen all of those pieces and they come back a new warrior. So it's kind of like same sort of like narrative arc. You know what I mean? You get your butt kicked and then you have to ask yourself, well, what happened? If the philosophy was true, everything should have worked out, but it didn't. So what was missing?
I love that narrative and that metaphor. We love a good Bruce Lee metaphor.
We love the training montage.
Yes. And so speaking of like finding out what's missing and you helping folks as far as organizations, solo artists, and even entrepreneurs and small businesses, how did you develop your expertise in coaching?
So first, I'll do a quick redefinition just to kind of put us on the same page. For years, I called what I did business coaching. After I got a certificate in coaching, I decided from now on, I'm going to call everything that I did previously and going forward, business consulting, because it's really about giving a download of information, best practices, concepts, skills, etc. Now I'm reserving the word coaching for the leadership coaching that you and I do, that type of work, which is more focused on not a download of information, but helping bring forward knowledge that you as the client already have. And so I distinguish the difference between the two. But as far as how I became a coach, I really learned it from my coaching program. I was very fortunate to participate in a really strong program that really gave a really strong introduction into that field. But as far as like how my business consulting came about, for me, it was realizing over the years, I was always giving like the same advice. I'm like, hey, you don't have this piece in place or you don't have this piece in place. And you say it like 20 times and you realize, oh, that should just be standardized. So that happened over and over again until I actually came up with like a more formal system of things that I could call uniquely Art of Hustle. Right. And a lot of it is informed by my prioritization of communications. When people say, what's the difference between you as a business consultant and anybody else? I always say language. My priority is language, because I feel like if you can communicate internally who you are, what your value is, what you do, who you serve, and why you're awesome, you could also do that externally. And then a lot of your problems will actually be solved. Because the number one thing most people face is they don't know how to communicate their value. So if we can get around the communications hurdle, most people's problems will be solved. Of course, there's more around business structures and finances, et cetera. There's always going to be more to learn. But in the beginning, when people approach me, they always say, I'm so good at what I do. I'm so committed to it, but I can't get the ball moving. What's wrong? And when I do that analysis, I always find, oh, you're not communicating it well to your audience and also not to yourself as the provider, right? Because if you were your own company, you would have an internal communications sort of like protocol where you would communicate to your team, even if you're a team of one, who you are, what you do, why you're awesome, whom you serve, and, you know, why you're especially qualified to do this work. So for me, it all centers around communications and language.
Yeah, I love that. It's also what I'm hearing from you too. It's centering the communication and the language, but also having people find that intention and mission statement.
Yes. Yes. Most people have it in their head, but you gotta write it down. Because, you know, there's an old saying I used to share a lot. I don't even know who started it now. When you think it, it's an idea. When you write it down, it's a plan. So I always encourage folks, you got to write it down. Get it out of your head. And it's game changing. It's alchemy, honestly.
Yes.
Yes.
That was on my vision board this year. Speaking of intention and making a plan, I mean, I think intention is the number one step to manifesting anything.
Yes. Yes. And what better way to claim that intention than to speak it and write it down, right? Can you really say you intend something if it stays stuck in your head? It's like hard.
Yeah, and then when you share it with someone like a coach or a consultant, you're speaking it out into the universe and now you're accountable.
Yes, yes. And now someone can help you, which brings us back to the community vibe, right? Don't do it all by yourself. You don't have to.
This is why I pay Anthem the big bucks. It's not that much money. No. I love this full circle moment. Again, yeah. We love these full circle moments on Cultural Cultivators about community and resources. And when you think about it being, oh, all my resources are from this, like, idea of... lack of a better word, the man, that is very limiting. Mm-hmm. But when you think about your resources being your community.
Yes.
It is almost, the potential is unlimited.
Yes. Yes.
It's not just a piece of the pie. It's like the whole pie.
Yeah. As the saying goes, none of us are as strong as all of us. So how can we tap into that more regularly?
I know you said don't ask about specific stories, but could you think of someone that you've helped, or even maybe in your own personal experience where you've tapped into resources and it has manifested in a plan being executed or successfully manifesting into this world?
The reason why I didn't want to share those stories is because there are, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn. Because honestly, and I'm actually not, because all I'm really doing is facilitating someone's success. They're doing the work. It's not like I go in there and tinker around and make their life awesome. Like, I go in there as a support partner, and then they do the work, and then they make their own life awesome. So it's really not to toot my own horn. There are so many success stories. A lot of them, obviously, I could point to, like, financial successes. But as far as, like, somebody that I would give, like, sort of like a shout out to or highlight specifically that I feel like had success that just could not stop, I would name Paloma Concordia. So Paloma, when she first reached out to me for business consulting help, was... I hope she doesn't mind me sharing it. She has shared it on video previously. So I'll just kind of like give a high level summary. Paloma had shuttered her business to pursue full-time work. That full-time work, she thought, this is adulting. This is what grown-ups do. And this is how we get stability. She gets laid off. So that idea flew right out the window. She had to reopen her business. And her struggle at the time was, how do I reactivate my business? It's been quiet for a while. Will people even remember me? Will it be okay for me to reach back out? Like, how does this all work? And so she and I worked together for a pretty lengthy period of time where I introduced a lot of the systems. And her business blew up. And so far as I could tell, never stopped blowing up. Like, she just kept going. And so I feel very fortunate to be a witness and participant and supporter in her relaunching her practice. And so that would be an example where she just did fantastic.
We love Paloma.
She's amazing.
She's like everyone's publicist.
Yes. Yes, as she should be. As she should be.
She's our publicist in Undiscovered and everything. She gets us, you know, media and articles. And she's amazing at what she does.
Yeah, fantastic. And again, look at her superpower. She's culturally competent, and she also has the business skill and the technical know-how for her particular practice. So it's like all those things combined make her awesome to work with, but also hugely successful.
And she's rooted in community.
Exactly. Exactly. Right?
Like, she gets that.
Yes. And it's part of what makes her fantastic. Yeah. Exactly.
See, that's a great example.
I'm glad we talked about it.
So you talked about reframing.
Mm-hmm.
It can be tough for folks to do, especially when we're stuck in these patterns of being from, I'm just going to say it, racism or colonization or capitalism. So what are some tips on reframing concepts in something that's less stressful for folks? Because I think that the immediate reaction and reframing is to push back. And our ego's like, I don't like that.
Give me an example.
Ooh. So for a long time, for me as an artist, it was the whole trope of starving artist. Don't be an artist. You're going to be a starving artist. So it took me 15 years to reframe that, to even think about the possibility of making money from my art.
So I'll say this. I don't know if this is the exact answer, but I'll say this. We're artists, right? So a big part of what we do is see things from other perspectives. A lot of times I find artists who have this superpower limited to their particular genre or discipline. But if we were to expand that to include just life, we could see so many things from other perspectives, right? And so just having that willingness to look at a different angle and not be so committed to a single way is artistic living, is the way I would look at it, right? So it's really just an invitation to say, well, we are artists anyways. What's the other way to look at it, right? So you're in film, right? There's a straightforward way to shoot a scene. And there are a million and other ways to shoot the same exact scene. So when you're looking at your own life, what are the million and other ways to look at the scene? And that sort of like invitation, that call to see things differently, is like probably the beginning of it. And then to give yourself grace. That part, that's the part, right? So one way to practice that is to give other people grace. Then you could use the same techniques on yourself. You know what I mean? It's harder to do it to yourself in the beginning because we're stuck in our own minds and worlds. Like, that's the nature of like being in a human form. But like, if we could look at other people and give them grace, then that would be the beginning of it. So I remember reading a long time ago a scene in a book that said, imagine there's a person, a parent with kids, and they're acting unruly on a bus or on a subway train, and they're annoying you. They're ruining your morning because they're being loud and obnoxious. So that's one way to look at the situation. But what could you do in your imagination to give this person backstory so that you could understand their situation? And I wish I could remember the exact book, but this book basically said, now imagine this same person is coming back from a funeral. Now it gives context to why they might be checked out and not minding their kids, and why their kids are acting crazy and unruly. Now we have more empathy for them. So nothing really changes in the scene, but your ability to imagine a person's experience. And so if we could do that for as many people as possible that we come across in the world, right? Or in your immediate world, at least, then it's a good practice to build up muscles to be able to start doing that for yourself. To be graceful with yourself, to say, well, I also come from tough times. I didn't have all the resources. I didn't have the best access, all opportunities or upbringing. And it's fine. I'm actually doing better than I thought, right? And then to start to explore all those other narratives that you could possibly inhabit, which are, again, rounding up to a million and one, are a million and one. So that would be like probably the beginning of like how a person might start to reframe parts of their world.
This idea of imagination, oftentimes I think about one of my superpowers. I was the only child growing up, so I had an overactive imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Talked to my toys, you know, made worlds out of nothing. So I think a lot of that, of course, manifested in my artistry and acting and being a writer and being able to visually tell a story as a filmmaker. But I think it's also a superpower in that I have this ability to reframe so much more easier than like past me, like 20-year-old me.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, I'm not holding on to negative emotions or thoughts or ideas as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for me to reframe those ideas into something more positive.
Yeah.
And spin it into a more optimistic, and also giving myself grace,
mm-hmm.
especially as a mother, full-time working mother creative.
Mm-hmm. I think it might also have something to do with, you know, wisdom, right? From just being older. Science says you're actually not even an adult human until you're like in your mid-20s.
25.
Right? So your brain is still mush, honestly, right? So of course you're going to be like totally trapped by your own brain chemistry for a long while. So I think there's something about like everything just kind of like easing up biologically where we could start to maybe, I don't know the facts, but as a suggestion, I think that has something to do with it, is getting more distance away from your own emotions and reactivity.
Yeah. Having the wisdom and the ability to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A new world.
Yes. Yes.
Love it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to ask this because I think one of your superpowers is finding the optimism and the positivity in people,
mm-hmm.
and also helping them find that way to reframe.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just talk more about how that plays into the work that you do?
That's a really good question. So I can only speak to my own optimism at the moment. And then I think if other people are inspired by it, then that's like just like a happy byproduct, right? Because everyone's responsible for their own happiness. So I'll say, I think generally speaking, I like to over-index on optimism because this world is rough and it just gets rougher, I think, as you get older, right? Like it doesn't actually get easier. It just gets more complicated and more difficult. Adulting is no joke, okay? So I like to over-index on optimism, and I like to get served a proper beatdown if I'm going to lose at something.
What? That's the tell
way
me more.
That's the way I look at it. Because so many people beat themselves before they even get out of the gate, right? So many people who are not optimistic say, well, that's not going to work for me. And then they don't even try. My whole thing is give it a shot. Give it lots of opportunities to fail. Like really know that you failed because you really tried, right? Rather than saying no to so many opportunities right out of the gate because you don't even believe in your own dream. So my whole thing is like, let the world tell you it's the wrong move. If it legit is the wrong move and it's really not going to work, go for it and have that experience. Then you'll really know. But don't fail in your mind first and then not even try. So I feel like, yeah, give it a shot. Give it a shot. And I think my optimism is also like rooted in action, right? It's not like forcing a smile on your face, because sometimes you don't want to smile.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be true to your feelings, right? So it's not really about forcing yourself into happiness, but at least giving things a shot. Like keep trying no matter what. And then if you're going to lose, lose properly, right? Think about competitions, sporting events. The reason why sporting events exist is because no one knows who's going to win. So you try. You get what I mean? Like, that's the reason sporting events exist, is because you actually don't know which team or which athlete. So both have to try as hard to find out. So you don't go out into a field, metaphorically or literally, and say, well, we're not going to win anyways, and then give up before the opening of the game actually starts. So go out there and lose. If you're going to really lose, go out there and give it 100% and then see if you do lose. Otherwise, there would be no tournament, right? There'd be no reason. You'd just be like, okay, everyone stay home. You all worked out, but stay home, because we all know for a second and third place. But you don't know. And upsets happen all the time. So there it is.
And do you have personal experience from that?
Probably. Just the launching of Art of Hustle. Didn't make sense. What business does an artist have be promoting entrepreneurship? None. No business whatsoever. I'd never done anything like that before in my life. And let me tell you this story about how Art of Hustle started. The very first workshop I ever gave, like today we take for granted, we have Zoom and then we got good lighting, we got filters and we got, like, you know, nice microphones and good recording equipment and all of this. And we have Instagram, right? But in 2010, with no budget, no money, and just a random crazy idea, I launched my very first workshop in the lobby of a dark theater, because I was friends with folks at the theater. And I said, hey, I want to give a workshop. Are any of the rooms available? None of them were available because there were rehearsals happening all throughout. And they said, but we'll let you use the lobby if you promise to lock up after yourself. So I was given the keys. I did my workshop around a utility table. 8 people showed up and paid me like $30. I didn't even have a slide deck or a projector or anything. I did everything on worksheets that I printed at home and collated and stapled myself. And that's belief, right? Just to say, I'm crazy for doing this. But whatever, let's try it. And it was enough of a proof of concept for me to say, well, I made whatever that math was, $200. Not a lot of money, but it was something. And after the workshop, people said, what was that concept again? What was that thing? Oh, I wish I could take another workshop. Or I wish you could coach me personally. And then that's when I just started responding to, like, the asks of specific people, but the asks of the universe. And I just kept responding. You want another workshop? I'll give you another one. You want more worksheets? I'll give you that. You want more access? I'll give you that. You want coaching? I'll give you that. Like, whatever you want, let's go. But it all started with, like, no budget whatsoever, right? It was like, it was what it was. And so everyone's got to start somewhere. And that would be an example of me just, like, taking this crazy leap. And, you know, 14 years later, it's gone through so many iterations and it's still alive and doing its own thing, right? I'm just, like, watering it. It's like this crazy plant that I grew from nothing.
It's a tree.
Yeah.
It is literally a tree. Full-on
tree. Yeah.
It's a fruit-bearing tree that is feeding other artists, other organizations. It's not just a little plant anymore.
Yeah.
So 100%. It's don't stop yourself before you even start.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
That's step one. Step one. That's not the only step.
No.
But it's one of the most valuable steps. Yeah.
Because a lot of times, like, for decades, I've had ideas that just sit in my head.
Yeah.
And now, literally this year, I'm like, I'm actually going to start this idea.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they need to germinate, right?
That's true, too.
There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
So how do you, as a consultant or even a coach, know when that difference of when it's time to start and when maybe this idea this artist has just needs to germinate some more?
Well, I mean, in my own experience, I just feel like it calls you.
Mm.
And once it calls you, it's like there's kind of like nothing you could do about it. That's the way I think about it. Like, it really is almost like an obligation to your art, to creative power, to the universe, to the community. Like, when something calls you, you just have to do it. It's almost like it's a responsibility. And when it comes to artists, I'll always know because they'll have started tinkering. That's normally a really good sign. When someone hasn't started tinkering yet, I won't tell them, but I could tell. It needs more time or they need to build more confidence around it. But once someone starts tinkering and saying, hey, I built this thing, it's ugly, but do you think it can fly? Then it's an opportunity for an outside expert like myself or someone else to say, well, let's look at it. Can it fly? I don't know. What do you need to adjust? Now we have something to analyze. But when something's just an idea in someone's head, you can't really analyze it. Mm-hmm. Just an idea. Then it's like more of like an abstraction. It's more of a intellectual practice. But once someone starts building something, then it's easier to analyze it because there's something actually live and going. It's like a tree. Going back to the tree metaphor, right? You cannot prune a tree as it's starting to break ground. You have to let that thing get a little bit wild and crazy, and then you could prune it and start to give it shape. And so that's the way I look at it, is let people grow their trees, let it get a little bit wild and crazy, maybe even, again, ugly, right? But at least you'll have something to work with. But if someone shows me a seed and they go, well, what do you think of this? It's like, well, we can't do anything with it yet. So start growing it, play around with it, have fun with it, and then come back once it starts to get a little bit wild and crazy. Then we could do something. You know what I mean?
Have fun with it.
You have to have fun with it because life is hard. And if you're not having fun, it's going to be very easy to get discouraged. So you should at least lead with a little bit of fun for sure.
So my intention this year is joyful evolution.
Love it.
So I feel like that also circles back to the positivity and optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And finding that within your practice, whatever it may be, even if you're not an artist, what is the joy?
I believe in the power of people to transform. I think that's one of the central things. Throughout my work as an artist, the idea was that people would look at the art and have a transformational moment. And in the business consulting and even now in the leadership coaching work, it's still kind of like rooted in this belief that people who want to change have the ability. So that's really central to the work. And I think that's what makes it fun for me, is to watch people make their own pivot, right? That's one of the main things. This world is so hard. There's so many forces we're up against. And just to believe that someone can make a change for themselves is like a super powerful experience to participate in, to witness, to support, and just to have as a value, honestly, right? The second we give up on people, then what are we doing as community members or as just even individuals, as people, right? So I feel like that's really central to my work. And I think that's fun to see people evolve.
Evolution. Joyful evolution. Joyful
evolution. Okay.
What's your mission statement?
Oh my gosh.
Put you on the spot.
Well, it's evolved so many times over the years.
2024, what is your mission state?
Yeah, I think it's to contribute to people's personal and professional improvement. At its most simple, that's probably what it is. And there's 1,001 ways to do that, right? So that could be done through the coaching or workshop facilitation or introduction of materials or whatever, right? There's like the how is like 1,001. But I think if I can continue to basically help people in that way, personally and professionally evolve, that would be very, very satisfying.
I feel like it takes a special kind of person to have that mission statement. And for you to find that for yourself, that's beautiful.
I feel like it's also rooted in me believing in my own transformation, right? That's probably a big part of it too. That like, I want to know that I can change. Mm. I want to know that I'm not stuck in a circumstance because of my background, because of how I grew up or because of where I live or because of how I look or, you know what I mean? Like we all want to believe, I don't want to impose that on everybody, but I would like to think that we all want to believe we have the ability to change. So I think it's central to my own outlook on life that I believe that change is possible. And so I want to believe in it for myself and for everybody that I serve.
What are ways that you have incorporating your life to evolve and transform?
Well, obviously we're full human beings, right? So we're talking a lot about work, but it's got to be multifaceted. So you got to take care of yourself physically, mentally, et cetera. So I have a colleague that likes to do this check-in called PIES, P-I-E-S, which I think is really a nice check-in. So everyone feel free to borrow it. But it's an acronym that stands for how are you doing physically, intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually. So I feel like those are good buckets. And as far as like transformation, evolution, like those are all things that contribute. And so if we could all sort of be mindful of each one of those buckets, I think that would be a good place to start. So physically, I've been practicing jiu-jitsu for the better part of a decade almost. And so that's sort of like an intellectual practice, but it's also like just fun, again, leading with fun. And so that's a big part of it. So martial arts for me is a metaphor, but it's also like literal. And then more recently, I hired a strength coach. So shout out to Oakland's Most Powerful. That's the name of the gym where I do my training. And so there's data out there that basically says after 30, you can lose up to 5% of your muscle mass every decade until you make your exit, right? So that's not good. So to defeat that loss of muscle mass, you actually have to strength train. You have to do resistance training. So that's something I'm trying to get involved with right now. Physically, obviously, in my household, we try to not eat so much processed foods. We try to eat plants, nature-made plants. Plants are good. Intellectually, I'm always trying to problem solve something, right? So I'm always picking up some kind of book on something. So there's no real shortage of just being intellectually curious. If anything, I need to stop myself from being always curious because we have the internet now. So it's super easy to open a loop and then want to close it by a Google search. And before you know it, you're just stuck in your phone all day, right? So for me, I don't have the problem of not being intellectually curious. If anything, I need to dial it back because I'm opening too many loops that can only be closed by interacting with the internet. So that's not healthy either. Emotionally, I have gone to therapy up to 4 or 5 times in my life that I can remember. It's important work. A lot of us sustain a lot of damage. So it's hard for folks to admit. It's hard for people of color to admit. It's hard for Asians to admit. It's hard for Filipinos to admit, right? But it's like there's so much we go through that sometimes can be best addressed by having a professional listen to you and reflect back to you what your experience is. So I think that's a way to think about it. I think spiritually, I don't have a specific spiritual practice, but I like to watch the lectures of spiritual teachers from like Pema Chodron. I like Thich Nhat Hanh. I like Ram Dass. I switch them up depending on my mood, you know what I mean? Because I don't like have a specific teacher that I follow to the ends of the earth. But what's cool is if you listen to enough of them, the lessons start to overlap and recur. And you go, oh, well, that's the thing. It shows up over and over again. That must be a thing to pay attention to. So those are some of the things, I guess. It's not an exhaustive list.
No, those are great things, especially therapy.
Yeah.
Shout out to all our therapists.
Yeah. Mental health worker. Thank you for everything.
All right. I'm going to ask this because, you know, we've talked a lot about artists, but we also deal with entrepreneurs with Cultivate Labs. We have Seed Network, which, you know, we give resources to entrepreneurs and small business owners. What's one piece of advice you'd give to Filipino entrepreneurs today that helped you or actually would have helped you when you were starting your own business, Art of Hustle?
Oh my gosh, Nicole. Hold on. The one piece, there's actually lots of pieces, but the one piece for the sake of the question is make sure that your business has a boss. Most people start a business and they just end up taking on the work of an employee inside of their business. And most people's experience with earning money is as a wage employee. when you're a wage employee, whatever, in your teens or whatever that job was, if you wanted to make more money, most people will tell you they would just work more hours. That makes sense when you're trading in your time for money as a wage employee. That's the nature of the relationship. When you're a business owner, your hours don't mean anything because you're not getting paid on an hourly. You're getting paid to be good. You're getting paid to be strategic. You're getting paid to be effective. You're getting paid to be efficient. So you're getting paid to learn how to leverage your resources. But a lot of early entrepreneurs will think, again, classic early learnings. Work hard, put in the hours, you'll get rewarded, right? It's very strangely Puritan. But now that doesn't work as an entrepreneur because, again, this is how people burn out. So they get into the work, they put in these long, exhaustive hours. They don't necessarily get paid more, but they're putting in the hours and then they burn out and then they quit. This is something I've seen a lot. Maybe business is not for me. And then I always feel really bad about it because they never were in business. They were doing the work of an employee that was getting burnt out at a job that had no boss. So what does it look like for a person to be the boss of a business? You have to be a leader. And as a leader, your job is to manage. Your job is to strategize, to do visioning work, to leverage your resources, to ask yourself, well, what's working? Let's do more of that. What's not working? Maybe we should stop that, right? It's to regularly ask questions and to treat yourself to retreats. And I don't mean luxury retreats. I mean quiet time where you could actually analyze the operations of your business, ask those big questions, and make adjustments. That's what a proper boss and leader would do for their company. But again, so many people get tied into product creation and service delivery, and then they just burn out and they go, I don't know what happened. Business is terrible, right? Well, it would be terrible if you didn't have a boss and you were just working your butt off, right? With no one giving you direction. And that's most of the times what happens with folks when they start out. So I would say make sure that like you're developing yourself as a leader and that your company has an actual boss that's making decisions on behalf of the company and not just an employee that's getting burnt out on product creation and service delivery.
That's so good. That's such great advice.
That's for real. That shows up over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, even as an artist and thinking about the project that I'm going to be working on this year, yeah, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Remember that.
Thank you. What's next for you?
I really want to pursue more work as a leadership coach. It's something that's super rewarding. It's a new skill. It's a new arena for me. And I think more broadly where I feel like that skill might be applicable would be in the field of learning and development. It's such a new field. They don't have a standardized name for it. So some people call it training and development. Some people call it learning and leadership. But basically, it's where organizations or companies commit to creating professional development opportunities internally, have places where employees can grow, can develop, can really focus on employee happiness, well-being, and retention. So those are all things that I feel like I believe in, and that's the field where I feel like I might excel and flourish in next. But who knows? That's just an idea at the moment.
Are you taking out new clients?
Yes. Holler. Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think happy to have a conversation with anybody just to make sure it's a good fit. Leadership coaching is really for folks who do operate in a leadership role and don't necessarily need a technical download. Like I said, that's where I'm distinguishing the difference between my business consulting and my leadership coaching. So I'm definitely interested in working with folks who are already technically sound and just need to work through more leadership development in their work.
And it's life-changing, I want to say, as a testimonial.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
It's something that I didn't know I needed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so happy I signed up.
As am I. Thank you.
Last question. What are you currently geeking over?
I think I'm semi-obsessed with health and wellness, so probably that. I think that would be one of the main things, honestly. Like if a YouTube or Instagram video pops up on nutrition or strength training, I'm probably going to watch it. So I'll stick with that answer. Yeah.
That's such a adult answer.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's so important. Going back to artist indoctrination, like so many of us think of jocks as antithetical to artistry, right? So then the only people who are allowed to focus on their health and wellness are people that we consider to be jocks. But again, who does that hurt? Us, right? So as artists, I think it's also important to think about your physicality, your physical body, because we're trained to think of ourselves as like spiritual or intellectual and of the mind, and creation comes from some place that's inside your body, but not of your body, right? Mm. So I think it's super important for us to kind of like reconnect with the fullness of ourselves. You can be an artist and an athlete. They're actually not antithetical to one another. You could be everything. No one says you have to be one thing. So I think it's as important. It's part of like the same mission with the artist and entrepreneurship. Again, they're not on opposite ends of the spectrum. They're actually connected. So same thing with the physicality. It's like one of those things I see a lot of artists neglect their bodies. And one day I'm going to find a way to integrate everything.
But yes. Yeah. That's the new iteration. Yes.
That's the new wave.
Well, thank you so much, Anthem.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Nicole.
For coming and blessing our space with your wisdom and your experience and your knowledge, all things coaching and consultant wise.
Yeah. I'm very grateful for the conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I loved how Anthem got real with us today. This idea that success comes from going it alone and working hard in silence and somehow magically getting recognized without focusing on money is such a common narrative. And his realization that this one-size-fits-all narrative really only fits if you're already starting from a place of privilege with money and opportunities and a strong network at your disposal. For those marginalized communities, this approach isn't just unhelpful, it's harmful. And it can lead to feelings of isolation, struggling alone. It also might even stall your career before it's even off the ground. And it makes us reliant on those gatekeepers and people in power that created this harmful narrative in the first place. So, as BIPOC artists, how do we flip the script? Anthem's suggestion, instead of flying solo, shift to teamwork. It's about doing it together and leaning on one another. An example from my own life, when I actually first started creating and writing my very first comedy pilot, I was approached by a production company and producer that promised me the world, resources, connections. But then they wanted $60,000. And look, I am not a trust fund baby. My parents are both from working class. I didn't have 60K at my disposal. So instead of going with that production company, I reached out to folks in my community, folks who I trusted. And with their help, not only was I able to film my comedy pilot, but I filmed my first 5 short films. And this is a perspective that I apply in all of my creative and artistic endeavors, because for BIPOC folks, it really does take a village. And that quote, "It takes a village," translates into a network that provides emotional support, shared resources, and opens doors for each other. It also means mentorship, where those who have navigated the system before can also guide newcomers. And it's about advocacy, where voices coming together demand change, making the system more accessible and equitable for everyone. Taking a closer look at Anthem's idea of wealth, not as something to avoid, but as a resource, opens up a new way of thinking. For creatives, especially those coming from less privileged backgrounds, the conventional narrative has often painted money as the root of all evil, something to be rejected in the pursuit of their art. However, reimagining wealth as a tool changes the game, not just seeing it as money, but also as resources. For an artist, that might mean having the means to workshops and coaches, or access to spaces where they can create and showcase their work, like our very own Creative Growth Artist Program, where we feel it's important to transform the word wealth from a symbol of greed to a catalyst for creativity and expression. The Creative Growth Program Belay is about setting up a foundation for future generations. It's also about breaking this cycle of scarcity and struggle, offering this next wave of BIPOC artists and thinkers a starting point that's a step further along, a platform from which they can leap higher. In a world where resources are unevenly distributed, redefining wealth as a resource to be utilized rather than shunned is a powerful shift. It encourages a communal approach to success, where resources are shared and the success of one becomes the success of many. And wealth in this context isn't just about having more. It's about doing more. It's not just about accumulating money, but about leveraging resources for growth, for art, and for the well-being of communities now and in the future. You can book a coaching session with Anthem at artofhustle.com. If you are a BIPOC artist living in the San Francisco Bay Area and want to apply to our next Creative Growth Program, where we provide artists with resources, stipends, and free coaching, sign up for our e-newsletter at belaycreative.org or follow us on Instagram at belaycreative. Cultural Cultivators is hosted by me, Nicole Saliver. You can follow me at Kindred Capua or follow us at cultural.cultivators with a K on Instagram. This podcast is co-produced by John Reyes, Kindred Capua, and Belay Creative, and is a product of Cultivate Labs.